Today on Reader's Corner, Russian expert and scholar Daniel Treisman, author of The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev.
The sanctions and the uncertainty about Russia's political direction, the economic circumstances in Russia, is going to weigh very heavily on the economy. There's going to be much less investment by foreigners and by Russians. But if you look at the problems, the challenges that Russia has faced in the last 25 years, they're really remarkably similar to the problems and challenges that arise in other countries at similar levels of economic development. Russia, if it continues to get much richer than it is today, will start to look quite anomalous. There aren't many countries that are richer than Russia today that are as authoritarian.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Generations of Western leaders have puzzled over how to manage their nation's relationship with Russia, and headlines in recent months, especially from Ukraine, have only deepened this long-standing challenge. But Daniel Treisman, in his book The Return, From Gorbachev to Medvedev, argues that Western notions about Russia as an antagonistic and autocratic behemoth are at best oversimplified. His book, an extensive work on Russia's recent history, takes issue with some of the West's prevailing beliefs and highlights the personalities that have shaped Russia's return to the international stage after the fall of the Soviet Union. His expertise and insight are especially relevant given the increasingly acrimonious relations between the West and Russia over ongoing events in Ukraine and other global flashpoints. Dr. Treisman is a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on Russia's politics and economics in the post-communist era. The Return, From Gorbachev to Medvedev, was named one of the best political books of 2011 by the Financial Times and is now out in paperback. Dr. Treisman joins us by phone for this interview. Daniel Treisman, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. Good to be here.
In regard to these Western notions and criticisms of Russia that I mentioned in the introduction, you say in your book that you reached a much more measured assessment. I want to talk about that assessment, but let's just kick it off by asking you if anything's changed in that overall assessment since this conflict in Ukraine, the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner, and all that's transpired since then.
Well, I'd say very simply that Putin has changed. I think if we look at his behavior, his choices, then there was a fairly rational and easy to understand logic behind the decisions that he was making up until early this year. I think with the sending of special forces troops into Crimea, we passed a real turning point, and it's no longer possible by looking at the costs and benefits to make sense of Putin's decisions. So I think he's changed in a way which is fairly common in leaders who stay in power for a very long time. They tend to get isolated and start to make mistakes. But I would say that's the biggest change. And unfortunately, at the moment, because Putin has such control over the political system in Russia, that imposes change on the country, even though underneath, I think the country has been moving in a different direction towards a more modern society, greater diversity, greater education, and breadth of views. So I think increasingly we're seeing a gap between the political regime and the society underneath.
Before we went on the air here, I shared with you a little news bit that I heard this morning that perhaps this Russian convoy that's been rumored to be on its way to Ukraine was going to cross the border in a couple of hours. And I guess whether it does or not, the question becomes whether or not this is a humanitarian convoy, as I guess Putin is trying to convince folks, or whether this is some kind of a Trojan horse that allows them to sneak Russian troops over the border. What's your take on where we are on just what this is, regardless of where it is?
Well, we can't know for certain, but it just goes to show how little trust there is at this point, how completely the possibility of taking anything for granted has disappeared in relations between Ukraine and Russia. It's certainly possible that there was some military purpose to these trucks. We just don't know. It's also possible that it was a humanitarian gesture, part of a PR campaign on Putin's part to improve the image of Russia while obviously delivering humanitarian aid. But we don't know. There were some reports that a surprising number of the trucks were not fully loaded, which raises the possibility that perhaps the real purpose was to bring things back rather than take things into Ukraine. But at this point, all we can do is speculate. Mm. But I do see that the customs have begun searching the trucks on the border, and it is possible that now we will see some of them moving into Ukraine.
I happened to be in London when the Malaysian airliner went down, and the reaction of the British press toward Germany and some of our allies over their coziness to Putin over recent years and their reluctance to take him on really got to a pretty shrill level, harsh criticism of Germany, for example, Angela Merkel, and her cozy relationship with Putin over the years. Now, since then, of course, Germany has taken action, but I wonder if you could assess for us where that's at. First of all, how significant is that? How dramatic or drastic is that? And then what impact is it really having in Russia? And is it likely to have even more impact as the months and year roll on?
Well, we do see that President Putin and President Poroshenko of Ukraine are supposed to meet in Minsk on Tuesday. So it seems that there will be some kind of negotiation. Putin seems to be looking for new options at this point. Merkel has been very important in the communications over these months. They haven't amounted to very much, but she has been talking to Putin regularly. And I think the shooting down at the Malaysian airliner was really a turning point in public opinion because it was just so shocking to populations throughout the West. In Germany, but not just in Germany, I think in the U.S. also, there was a great desire on the part of the business community to downplay the events in Ukraine, to hope that things would blow over quickly and we could get back to business, literally. I think that desire was wishful thinking from the start, and I think now there's more realism creeping in. So I think there has been a change in the business community in Germany. Merkel tends to move very slowly on all political matters to try to gather forces behind her, to feel the public opinion, and to gradually, very slowly, lead it towards the direction she wants to go, but not to get too far ahead of it. I think that public opinion has changed, and there is more unity on the part of the West, including business leaders. And we saw that in the much more stringent last round of sanctions that were imposed on Russia. Mm-hmm. Where this goes from now depends almost entirely on Putin. He's, I would say, somewhat in a corner now because the Ukrainian military forces seem to be doing very well, close to victory, it seems. They're fighting on the outskirts of Donetsk and Luhansk. So if the rebels are going to survive, if they're going to avoid a total defeat, something needs to happen fairly soon. That creates dangers, obviously, that Putin will gamble again and increase military support. But it also raises the possibility that he will explore diplomatic ways of slowing down the momentum and freezing the current balance of forces on the ground through some sort of ceasefire. So I think we're at that position. Putin's options are fairly narrow, and he's looking to expand them. And meanwhile, the West is, I think, fairly unified at this point. And I think in most foreign ministries, they're hoping that the Ukrainian forces will now finish the job, and then we can move back to something more stable. Mm-hmm.
What role does public opinion in Russia play in Putin's strategy to extricate himself from this crisis? Does he pay any attention to polls? This is not exactly a democracy that is in textbook form over in Russia. So to what extent does he have to care?
He has always paid a great deal of attention to polls, really, from the start. He's been very sensitive to polling. He's had an enormous number of polls done for the Kremlin. And I think he understands that even though elections have become rather imperfect, let's say, measures of public opinion, nevertheless, he has to worry about the potential for protests and just discontent throughout the population. So he's always been very conscious of that. Now, that's in part why it's so hard to understand the events since early this year, because although invading or annexing Crimea was enormously popular in the short run, his popularity rating shot up to the 80s. He's, I think, now at about 86% approval. And that's lasted for a few months. It seems very unlikely that this will survive indefinitely. In the past, his popularity has been very strongly connected to economic performance. Russia's economic performance has been declining steadily for the last few years. In fact, that might be part of the stimulus that led him to look for alternative sources of public support. But the sanctions and the general climate of uncertainty about Russia's political direction, the economic circumstances in Russia, is going to weigh very heavily on the economy. There's going to be much less investment, both by foreigners and by Russians. So really, this state of military conflict has created huge economic problems that are bound in the medium run to weigh on his popularity. Now, how he got into this situation, I think, is a fascinating historical matter, but he's going to face very serious problems, and it's not easy to see how he can get out of that.
You're listening to Daniel Treisman. He's a professor of political science at UCLA, and he's the author of The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. Well, just listening to some of the issues raised as to where Poland is going to unload its vegetables and fruit now that they're not heading to Russia, it can't be too long before consumers in those Russian supermarkets start asking how long they're going to go without the produce that they've become accustomed to. And that's when I would assume Putin realizes that in the end, he doesn't have the flexibility forever to do these kinds of things.
Well, of course, he must realize that already. It's quite bizarre. He's backed himself into a corner, and that's a very good angle from which to shoot yourself in the foot. And he keeps doing that. So they've imposed these bans on imported Western foods, which is perhaps even more powerful than the Western economic sanctions at punishing his population. Most recently, they've started attacking McDonald's, having lots of not entirely credible sanitary inspections, closing down some branches of the McDonald's, which again is something that hurts the population, the people who like to eat at McDonald's. So it seems that in lots of ways, the attempt to fight back at the West is really cutting off their nose to spite their face. And they're helping the Western pressure, or they're increasing the Western pressure through counterproductive actions. One always wants to think, well, is there some crafty, some brilliant secret plan, some logic underneath this that we're missing, but I haven't been able to come up with one. So, yes, the consumers are going to notice the lack of imported food goods. It's not clear that Russian agriculture and Russian industry can quickly replace all of those. Clearly, they can import a lot of things from other parts of the world. But in the short run, there's bound to be disruptions of supply. And in the long run, people are going to notice that certain things are missing. So this can't make people very happy. Now, at the moment, there's still this sort of euphoric sense of national achievement, having returned a small piece of land in Crimea to Russia, which was extremely popular. But how long euphoria can last is another question. In the past, we've always seen that after some sort of dramatic rallying point, like the war in Georgia or even the war in Chechnya, public opinion rallied behind the president for up to 6 months or even a year. But after that, it fell down quite rapidly to where it was before. And the underlying conditions are going to be worse at that point. So, and I would guess that they'll continue to ban things and prohibit behavior and do all sorts of punitive measures, which end up punishing nobody but the Russian population itself.
Before we move on to your to some of the things in your book, I do want to go back to the downing of the Malaysian Airlines flight. Again, I guess because I was a captive of London media and TV, and for that matter, all of Europe's media over those days, it was such a horrific few days getting reports of what had happened and how it had happened, rumors about who was responsible. As we look back on it now, is there any doubt that this airliner was shot down by the rebels with armaments that were supplied by Russia?
Well, we'd obviously need to wait for the final report of the investigators, but I don't see a plausible alternative at this point. Now, of course, there is a lot of doubt on that score in Russia, where the media has presented all sorts of alternative explanations, in particular that Ukrainian army military aircraft shot it down from the air. And the polls suggest that only about 3 to 5% of the Russian public believes that it was the Russian-supported Ukrainian separatists that shot down the plane. So the media in Russia has been successful in spreading doubt over there, but I don't see an alternative plausible scenario. I believe that there weren't Ukrainian aircraft anywhere nearby, that the Ukrainian anti-aircraft missiles were also far away from that area. So my presumption is the same as any newspaper readers, but of course we have to wait for the final verdict of the investigative committee, and we'll see that in due course.
Your book challenges Westerners to re-examine what we think we know about modern Russia, and that's what I found so interesting about it, is that there are misconceptions, and you've tried to straighten some of those out, or, as you say, give a more measured analysis of Russia over the years. Is there one greatest misconception that Americans have about Russia? I know at one point you talk about Gorbachev as the history's most successful failure, which I thought was a great way of putting it. And then you comment also on things like electoral reform and Friedman's thesis that the higher the price of oil in Russia, the less freedom there'll be in Russia, and other aspects of Russian life like freedom of the press, crony capitalism. Help us understand what the real Russia looks like as opposed to the Russia that sometimes comes across on TV or in the media.
Well, I think the biggest mistake that people make in looking at Russia is to look at it as unique and to throw out comparisons with other countries. Because if you look at the problems, the challenges that Russia has faced in the last 25 years, they're really remarkably similar to the problems and challenges that arise in other countries at similar levels of economic development. So if we look at Mexico, if we look at Turkey, if we look at Brazil or Malaysia, we see electoral systems which are very imperfect. They go up and down. So some improve, some deteriorate. There's a lot of variation, but we see a lot of electoral fraud, a lot of problems. We see high levels of corruption. We see economic instability very often. And we see life which is very unpleasant and uncertain in many ways for the population. Now, when we look at Russia, we tend to reach for these distant historical analogies and say this is all a consequence of Tsarist autocracy or the corruption of 19th century Russia, that there's this historical tradition that the Russians can never escape. I think, in fact, it's very natural for countries as they develop economically to very slowly improve the quality of their state, the quality of administration, the amount of economic freedom, the quality of elections, and so on, to become more democratic, more responsive, to have cleaner governments. And so we shouldn't be so surprised that Russia faced all these issues in the 1990s and since. We also see a lot of flip-flopping back and forth between more democratic periods and more authoritarian periods until countries make a final jump into consolidated democracy. Now, Russia, if it continues to get much richer than it is today, will start to look quite anomalous. There aren't many countries that are richer than Russia today that are as authoritarian as its current regime. In fact, there are only two groups. One group is the super oil-rich countries, mostly of the Persian Gulf, which has authoritarian politics. The only other group has one member, and that's Singapore. So there is an alternative model to be wealthy and authoritarian, but it's very hard to become a member of that club, which have managed to combine all the benefits of international competition in the economy with authoritarian politics. So Russia, if it becomes much richer, if it develops more, I think, going to have to become more democratic. The alternative is that it just won't develop economically. It'll stagnate. And I pointed this out at a panel in Krasnoyarsk about a year and a half ago to Russia's prime minister, Dmitry Medvedev, and his response was very interesting. He said, as someone who lives here, as someone who has worked in the government of Russia, I am sure that without democracy, there won't be prosperity in Russia, which is interesting because you can take it in two ways. There will be prosperity and there will be democracy, or that there will be neither. I think he meant the first, but one can also imagine that the real outcome will be economic stagnation and more politics of the kind that we've been seeing.
You're listening to Daniel Treisman. He's a professor of political science at UCLA, and he's the author of The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. So I know you can't get inside the head of Vladimir Putin, but I do have to ask this question since it's been in the news now for the last how many years since Edward Snowden was sheltered by the Russians. Where is that in the Putin strategy to modernize Russia, improve relations with countries that can provide economic benefit to Russia? And now I think he was just given a new 3-year residency permit, so it doesn't look like they think they made a big mistake here. Obviously, it builds anti-American support for Putin in Russia, and that's important to him, I guess. But your thoughts on why did they decide to do this?
As you say, we can't get inside Putin's head, and anybody who claims to know exactly what Putin's thinking, you should be a little bit careful. The people who actually know Putin well do not presume to say what he's thinking, and those who do are usually people like me who are quite far on the outside. With regard to Snowden, it appeared to me that that this was not something that Russia sought out, that Snowden pretty much arrived in Russia and then couldn't leave, essentially because the U.S. Made it clear that it would force any plane carrying him to land so that he could be arrested. So he couldn't move to any South American country, as I think he initially planned. And so he was stuck in Russia. And Russia has no extradition treaty with the U.S. because the U.S. had refused to sign one with Russia, not wanting to have to return people to Vladimir Putin's justice system. So at that point, clearly it would have looked like a sign of weakness if Putin had simply said, okay, we'll hand him over. So he chose not to. But I don't see a huge strategic decision on Putin's part in this case. There's certain benefit to being able to point out that the U.S. Has this very powerful system of spying on foreign citizens and maybe on its own citizens, given that the Russian secret services are accused of doing exactly that. And so Snowden is a bit of an image of the hypocrisy of the U.S., the hypocrisy of the West. But nevertheless, I think that Putin would have been quite glad and probably would still be quite glad to pass Snowden on to some other country if that could be arranged.
You mentioned earlier that you were at a conference where Medvedev was there, and forgive my less than Russian pronunciation, but he is the number two guy. What's the succession management plan? Anybody have any idea what the future holds here?
No one has any idea, because if they did, there would be immediate fights over that. I think Medvedev is quite smart. He's playing the role, as an opposition politician put it to me, he's playing the role of the weakling in the survivor. So he knows his task at the moment is to do nothing that could create waves. He's simply carrying out orders, and he's surviving. It was thought initially that he would remain as prime minister for 6 months, a year, He's been in there since Putin's return to the Kremlin. So it's always a possibility that he might end up, if there was some unforeseen chain of circumstances that led to Putin disappearing, that Medvedev would end up holding the reins. He's not highly respected, really, by any of his peers at the top of the Russian political system. So at most, one would imagine he'd be a temporary figure, but there is no clear successor, there is no clear heir. And, of course, that's completely deliberate because Putin plans to stay. And if he were to indicate that somebody was going to be his successor, then he would immediately become a lame duck, and that person would come under attack from all the other vicious factions in the Kremlin.
Well, let's close with a question about Mikhail Gorbachev. Of course, he's been a hero in America. I still remember when I lived in Chicago being invited to a dinner at the same table as Mikhail Gorbachev. I must admit that it was the longest dinner table I've ever sat at. And obviously it was during that era when we were glorifying the fact that he was the guy responsible for bringing down the Iron Curtain. Meanwhile, back in Russia, there's a different story to be told, I suppose. And that must have something to do with the moniker that you gave him, history's most successful failure. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, what I had in mind was that what he achieved, which I think was in the global scheme of things absolutely incredible, was not what he was aiming for. Perhaps that's unfair in international relations. He initiated the process of nuclear disarmament. He ended the Cold War, and that was deliberate, although I think it happened perhaps faster than he anticipated, that he set off processes in Eastern Europe that he didn't oppose, but he hadn't quite expected so fast. But nevertheless, he did begin this process of massive disarmament. He did have this new thinking about international relations, which some people saw as naive, but which did lead to this end of the global hostility between these two poles, the West and the East. In internal affairs, though, in Russia, I don't think he intended to democratize exactly. He intended to bring some fresh air, to allow more honest talk, to free the press somewhat, and to introduce finally some competition into the Communist Party. But he was a convinced socialist. He thought the Communist Party could be reformed and it could continue to govern. In the economy, he introduced a series of reforms which he hoped would reinvigorate the Soviet economic system. He believed that socialist economics could work, that it had just been done wrong and that it could be improved. And the details of the economic reforms that he introduced were illogical, and they ended up destroying the system entirely. So in that sense, he was a failure. He created the conditions which could lead to the emergence of democracy and free market economics in Russia, but he didn't intend that. And he's blamed by Russians for setting off this period of real economic contraction, of political chaos, as many felt it to be in the early 1990s. And so that's the legacy that he's associated with in Russia.
Well, a half an hour is hardly enough time to do justice to your book. But again, the title is The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. The author is Daniel Treisman, professor of political science at UCLA. Professor Treisman, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
My pleasure.
Next week, journalist and author Marin McKenna talking about antibiotic-resistant bacteria and the implications for human health. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.